Straight Talk on WRHI-FM 100.1 and CN2 is presented by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders. Now here's Manning Kimmel broadcasting live from Substation 2 on Cherry Road in Rock Hill with Straight Talk, selected by the South Carolina Broadcasters Association as the state's top public affairs program.
And welcome into our Straight Talk broadcast, brought to you by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, here with Founders. Also brought to you by Anderson Griggs Investments in Old Town Rock Hill. Common sense, intelligent advice for conservative investors. You can find out more online at AndersonGriggs.com. Good Pharmacy is with us, your hometown pharmacy, Ebenezer Road and Camden Avenue in Rock Hill. And, of course, as always, Piedmont Medical Center, a community built on care. You can find out more at PiedmontMedicalCenter.com. Our guest today has served on the board of directors of the South Carolina Writers Workshop from 2000 until 2006. He was vice president of the Southeast Chapter of the Mystery Writers of America from 2000 to 2005. He works professionally as an adjunct professor of digital design at York Technical College and is a Rock Hill resident. And joining us today is Craig Ferris, who until about 8 hours ago, I got turned on to a very interesting short story collection, a book by Craig, called A Den of Rhyme. And this is one of those deals that once you start into it, you kind of keep going because it's very difficult to put down. But welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about this. This is a collection of short stories, but not just your ordinary short stories, if you will.
I like to write suspense. I started writing suspense back in 1994, and it was kind of the last thing I ever thought I'd be good at. I wasn't that great at English in high school, and really, when I started writing, it was because I had a job that was really boring, and I was working a third shift. I was the only person there, and when I finished my stuff, I just left and went home. However, one day I was sitting there at my computer, and I was sending files to this printer, which would image pictures, and they would take forever to print. But then the only thing that would work on my computer was Microsoft Word. So when they just sat down and started writing the first page of this book, 226,800 words later, I finished this totally unpublishable novel, which I can't even describe the genre because it was such a total mess. But it taught me how to type, and it taught me how to finish a major work because there was a lot of plot lines and there was a lot of problems with it. And so I joined a writer's group, and the first thing they told me is, you really should write something short. And so I said, okay, well, what do you suggest? And they said, well, try writing short stories, you know, and try to give yourself a word limit. So they suggested I give myself a word limit something under 2,000 words. I asked why, and they said, because if you write short stories, it has all the major elements of a novel, but it only takes you 3 days instead of 3 years to finish it.
That makes sense.
Yes, which is nice, you know. And so the first novel I actually packed up, put in my attic, and it's happy there. It needs to stay there, probably like Harper Lee's Good Set of Watchmen needed to stay in that desk drawer. So you just never know, and and so then they convinced me, after I started writing a bunch of short stories, why don't you try writing another novel, but this time keep it under around 100,000 words. At that time, 120 was about the maximum. Nowadays, the maximum that publishers want is about 90,000 words. But I started this book called The Spectrum Conspiracy, and I really didn't know where it was going, but I had this premise. And the premise was that in the opening scene, they assassinate the President of the United States in the White House briefing room on live television. And the kicker is, even the assassin has absolutely no clue that he's the assassin. So that's how the book starts. And it just kind of went from there. I didn't really have any idea exactly where it was going to go, but it ended up doing actually pretty well. It ended up winning 9 literary awards. It won the Beverly Hills Book Award for Best Suspense Novel, and the Reader's Favorite Gold Medal. We had to fly to Florida, pick that up. That was nice. And then it was one of 7 finalists in the Killer Nashville contest in 2014. And so I went out there. I figured, well, I didn't know anybody there. They didn't know me. So I walked up to the president of the group, and I said, how many entries were there? I figured there's probably 25 entries or so. And he said, no, there were 1,000 entries.
Jeez.
I said, that's pretty good. And then I said, well, who else was in the contest? And he said, well, there were entries by Dean Koontz, Jeffrey Deaver, David Baldacci, and somebody called Stephen King. So that was pretty good company to be in.
Yeah.
I didn't win, but still, that was kind of nice. And so then I started collecting these short stories. And when I got to 20 of them, I decided, well, that's enough to put it together into a book. And so last year, my publisher decided, let's go ahead and publish these in a book. And his idea was to possibly put them out as e-books. Each story is individual e-books. So I teach graphic design out at York Tech, mostly Photoshop. And I told my students out there that we're going to have a contest at the end of this year for covers, book covers.
Okay.
And so I knew how to do book covers because I did my own book covers for The Spectrum Conspiracy and A Den of Rhyme. And so I told them, whoever designs this book cover, you're not going to get paid for it.
Right.
However, if your cover is picked, then you will be published worldwide. Now, there's a cover designed for each one of the stories in the book. And so 20 of those students ended up getting published worldwide, and they could put that in their portfolio, and not a single one of them turned me down on it.
No, so, I would think not. That's, you know, that's a pretty good opportunity there.
It is. So the thing I like to right is suspense, and suspense can be really, really simple. There is a story I read years and years ago, and it was called What's in the Box by Richard Matheson, and that book, that story really inspired me, and I started actually telling that short story to my children when they were little, and they always thought it was fantastic. It had a great ending to it. You know, and it really was suspenseful all the way around, and they never got tired of it. And so I decided, well, why don't I just go ahead and so I pulled back out the old copy of the original story, and I realized that there was only about 3 words in that Richard Matheson story that was anything like mine. I had changed it so much over the years and adapted it to myself. So I decided, well, why not, you know, tell the story myself? So anyway, I'll just give you an example of what this, my story was called Grand Slam. And this is about 3 boys who were playing baseball at the end of their cul-de-sac. There was Kirk, there was Dan, and there was Joey. Now, Joey was the pitcher, and Dan was at bat, and Kirk, he was out in the outfield, you know. However, at the end of the cul-de-sac, there was this old house, obviously an old house that had been original to the property. And the problem was the old house had no paint left on it. It was the window blinds and stuff, and everything were falling in. You know, the porch, it was all, you know, brown. And the tree and the yard was full of nothing but weeds and dead trees.
Yeah.
And so Dan ends up hitting this ball, and it goes over into that yard.
Had to happen.
Of that house. You know, and the house is surrounded by this old rusty iron fence. So the 3 of them walked up to the edge of the fence, you know, and they said, all right, Dan, go get the ball. You hit it in there. And Dan says, why don't we all go?
Mm-hmm.
So they said, okay. So they unlatch the gate, and it squeals out bloody murder as they open it. And then they kind of spread out through all these briars and you know, 3-foot grass and stuff. And it takes about 15 minutes before Dan finally finds the ball. And so he sees the ball, and he picks it up, and it's right beside the edge of the porch. And so as he raises up, he smells this odor that's kind of like, you know, cat pee and mold. And he looks up, and there's this cracked brown leather shoe on the other side of the banister. And as he follows that up, he sees this gray, moldy-looking pant slick. And the further he looks up, he sees this old wrinkled hand with yellow fingernails. And then there is this wild-looking hair, beard, and this guy looking down at him with piercing blue eyes. And so Dan stands up and he starts backing up. Kirk and Joey see him too, and they all three start backing toward the gate. And Dan says, "Sorry, mister, we just came to get our ball." And so then the old man sticks up this gnarly finger and he points up toward the hill and he says, "You see that big tree up on that hill? 4 o'clock this afternoon, walk 10 paces due north. Dig down 4 feet, and you'll get a big surprise." Well, of course, you know, they go home, forget about baseball. They get their picks and shovels and everything, and they go up to the top of the hill. They get the compass. They get up there, and they march off, you know, 10 paces due north. And then they mark a line in the ground, big square about 4 feet wide, and they start to dig. And they dig, and they dig, and they dig. And after about an hour, they're down about a foot because it's underneath this tree. And so they decide, well, you know, do we quit or not, you know? So they say, no, let's give it another hour. So they finally get down to beneath the root layer, and they dig, and they dig. And it's the wind starting to whip up, you know, and the leaves are swirling around now, you know. And Kirk looks over from the distance, and he sees there's a cold front coming through, and it looks like it's going to rain, you know. So Kirk climbs up out of the hole. He's the fat kid. There's always a fat kid. And he says,
the hero of
"Hey,
story.
Guys, you know, I was just looking down at that old house, and I thought I saw a glint of sunglasses from inside there, you know." He said, "That old man is sitting there laughing his head off at us because he got 3 kids to come up here and dig a hole in the ground as punishment for going into his yard, you know." And Dan says, "Well, why would he do that? You know, why would he tell us to come here and, you know, dig 4 feet down, you know? There's got to be something here, you know." So then Kirk says, I give up. I'm going downhill." So he walks off, you know, takes his shovel with him. And, you know, and then Joey yells out, "Well, you're not going to get any of the treasure." He said, "He didn't say anything about a treasure. He says a big surprise. That's it." So they keep digging. And they dig, and they dig, and they dig. And finally, after about 2 or 3 hours, it starts to rain. And now you get the pile of dirt that's gotten up around them. It's all big red clay and stuff, you know. And, you know, and Joey has to actually cut a couple footholds to even climb up out of the hole. It's gotten so deep. And so Dan says, "Where are you going, Joey?" And he says, "There is nothing here, Dan." And I said, he said, "There's got to be something here. He wouldn't have told us this particular spot, this particular time, you know?" So Joey says, "I have a theory. I think that Kirk was right. I think that old man, he's about 90 years old. He knows he's going to kick the bucket any minute. I think he got 3 kids to come up here and dig him a grave right where he wanted to be buried." And that's what he did, you know? Said, "I'm going home." So he marches off downhill. And there's Dan. He's sitting there. He's so frustrated now. He picks up a pick, and he takes it, and he swings it over his head, and he hits something hard, like concrete. And he can't get the pick out. And so he takes the shovel, and he digs around the pick, and he realizes that it's stuck in a crack. And so he starts uncovering this line, and he follows the line to one corner and then to another corner and to another corner, and he realizes that it's some kind of a trap door. And now he's sitting there, and he's looking at this thing, and he's thinking, "Hey, now I know it. I've got the treasure. I've got a treasure." So he finally takes the pick and jerks it up out of there, and the moment he jerks pick out of there, the lid starts to rise on its own.
All right, that's creepy
stuff,
yeah.
And Dan looks down at this inky blackness, and he can't believe his eyes. And he starts to back up, and the mud is all slick and everything. And as he backs up further and further, his feet start to slide out from under him. And then that old man rises up out of that hole and looks at him and says, "Surprise." in the story.
Oh, that's good.
So that's what suspense is.
That is.
Normally, when I tell this story, I stop right before the reveal and then change the subject. And everybody says, weren't you going to tell us? I said, well, that's the definition of suspense.
And that's the style of story that is in this book, A Den of Rhyme, is that?
Yes.
What attracted you to writing in the first place? I mean, you know, was this something that you did as a boy or a teenager? Or?
It was just one of those things. You know, like I said, it was a real boring job. But, you know, I actually hated writing term papers when I was in high school. Absolutely couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. And I had to write a term paper one time on Pulitzer. And I said to myself, you know, if I have to keep doing this all the way through high school, because this was, I think it was junior high that I did that one. I said, I'm just going to pull my hair out. And I said, you know, what you really need to do is you really need to memorize one book. But it's got to be a universal subject. So I started thinking about what would apply to history, what would apply to social studies, what would apply to, you know, English. And suddenly this old book that I'd read came to mind, and it was called A Night to Remember. Mm-hmm. It was written by Walter Lord, and it was about the sinking of the Titanic. And it was actually the most accurate book ever written about the sinking of the Titanic. So I memorized everything about that book, and I started writing term papers based on that story. And suddenly, instead of getting C's and D's, I was getting B's and A's.
Okay.
Because it was such an interesting story, and it applied to every subject. You know, I even wrote a math term paper about it one time. And that's because we knew that the water had risen 14 feet in the first 10 minutes. And we knew that the hole was 242 feet long because it opened 2 feet into the sixth compartment. And it was pretty easy to calculate the volume of that area because I had blueprints, you know, from the Titanic. And I realized that once I calculated the volume and divided that between the 242 feet, I realized that that hole was no bigger than 12 square feet, the size of your average front door.
Okay.
And so then I figured out that there's no place along that hole that couldn't have been any bigger than 3/4 of an inch. So this wasn't a tear. This was a dent, which broke these rivets, and all the water just sprayed in through the dent, basically. And that was it. No wonder they didn't find a tear in a hole when they found it.
That's interesting, because I've never heard that premise put forth before. Yeah. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. Craig Ferris is with us today. He, as you can tell, is an author, a very good one at that. And we're going to take a break and remind you that you are listening to Straight Talk, brought to you by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax here with Founders. And by Anderson Griggs Investments in Old Town Rock Hill. Common sense, intelligent advice for conservative investors. You can find out more online at AndersonGriggs.com. We broadcast the show live Monday through Friday at Substation 2 on Cherry Road in Rock Hill, across from Winthrop University, where they make fresh subs and salads right before your very eyes, Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. And the magical way they do this, as Craig and I will tell you, is slice, 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 garden, garden, garden. Back after this.
If it's 12:30, it's Straight Talk on WRHI and CN2.
There are lots of reasons why people like dining at Substation 2.
I like the friendly service, and I like that the meat's fresh and the food tastes good. They slice the meat right there in front of you.
Man, it's just utterly delicious.
I'm Charlie Ruffalo, and I guarantee you'll feel the same way after eating here at Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop.
Dr. Carrie Watson, the trauma medical director at Piedmont Medical Center, says she's very proud of what's being accomplished at Piedmont.
We are able to do robotic surgery. We are a robotic center of excellence, and that's robotic surgery for general surgery like gallbladders, hernias, colon. We also have robotic urology, so that's things like kidney removals and things with your bladder. We also have robotic neurosurgery that we're doing, and that's pretty amazing. Not a lot of places have that.
Piedmont Medical Center, a community built on care.
There are very few genuine money managers in America, and one just happens to be your neighbor.
If you have $100,000 or more, call the professionals at Anderson Griggs Investments and see what a money manager can do for you. Anderson Griggs, 324-5044, or go online to andersongriggs.com.
When disaster strikes, one of the most important things is getting life back to normal. A little compassion can go a long way. Paul Davis is here for you. Paul Davis is committed to handling any property damage with exceptional care, because what we do is about more than property. It's about people. We have the training and expertise necessary to completely restore your property fast. For all your cleanup and restoration needs, call the experts at Paul Davis Restoration at 329-1140 or find us online at pauldavisrockhill.com.
Last year was a big year for Founders Federal Credit Union and our amazing members. A total of $30 million was given back to qualifying members in the form of loyalty bonus dividends, proving once again that it pays to be a Founders member. Founders is also committed to pouring time and resources into the local communities we serve. If you aren't a member yet, what are you waiting for? Join Founders today. Visit foundersfcu.com. Federally insured by NCUA. Membership qualification required.
Have you ever wondered why so many people enjoy dining at Substation 2?
It's just always a great, consistent meal.
Enjoy the Italian sub with the salami.
I enjoy just the atmosphere.
I'm Charlie Ruffalo, and I guarantee you'll feel the same way after eating here at Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop.
Straight Talk on WRHI-FM 100.1 and CN2 is brought to you by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders.
Craig Ferris, local author, is with us today, our guest on Straight Talk, and we're talking about his second book, A Den of Rhyme, a short story collection, and it is exactly that. And I had a chance to start into it this morning for a few minutes, and was very intrigued. Where do you find your subject matter? I mean, how does it come to you? The first story was a baseball story, if you will, or at least it was loose. It's entitled House of Ruth, which we all automatically think of Yankee Stadium and, of course, right. Babe Ruth, and nothing could be further from the truth.
That's true. House of Ruth was actually based on real events. When I was 17, me and a couple other friends, we used to like to run to the Southern Trestle during the summer. I lived in Catawba, South Carolina. It was about 3.5 miles down to the Southern Trestle. And we would run down there, and then we would walk across a 1,260-foot trestle and walk back, and that would give us a chance to rest. And then one day when we were coming back, I remember these aerial photographs that my father had taken when he was instrumental in getting the Bowater paper mill moved there, and he had taken these photographs with Bob Bryant, who was a pilot at that time. And I noticed in those pictures that there were some houses that were off to our right side when we walked down the trestle. The Bowater plant was on the other side. And one day we came across what appeared to be an old railroad crossing. So we decided to actually go out into the woods, and we almost immediately saw the remnants of an old roadbed that was all completely grown up with briars and thorns and everything else. So we followed that old barbed wire fence out to the end of it and came upon this wall of kudzu. This was in September, so it was, you know, right at the end of the season. And so we didn't even know what that wall was until we saw a tin roof above it. And so Dan was the one who suggested that we go around to the other side of the house, and the porch had collapsed completely to the ground. And so we climbed up onto the porch and went in through the kitchen door and followed this hallway that led around to the other side. And all the window panes had all long since rotted out of their things, but the house had stayed dry because of the tin roof. One thing that I really noticed was that all the walls and ceilings were covered with newspapers, old newspapers from the 1940s and 50s. So it was evident that the house had not been occupied since then. And they had all faded, and, you know, some of them were peeling off and everything. And Dan was walking ahead of us, and he walked into what I guess was the den at that time. And then he saw this doorway that went in through a closet and came out the other side into a bedroom. And he walked through first, and he called us, and he said, "Hey, guys, I think I found the bridal suite." So we walked through that door. It was a little, like a little 6-foot door. It wasn't very high at all. And I did notice that there was some kind of a trap door underneath it. So we, as we went across there, he was looking up at the ceiling at this newspaper article that was still left there. And in that newspaper article, it talked about this shooting that took place in 1949. It was about a baseball player named Eddie Wakus. And Eddie Wakus had been an all-star with the Chicago Cubs. And then he had gotten traded to the Philadelphia Phillies. And the Philadelphia Phillies were back in town in the date. I can't remember the exact date it was, but it was in September 1949, I think. And he was scheduled to play that game. Well, they actually did. They were staying at the Edgewater Beach Hotel. And when he finished that game, they won that game, by the way, he came back and a bellhop gave him a note that had been given to him from this woman, and she had signed her name Ruth Burns. And this note had said, "I really need to talk to you, and I'm in room such and such upstairs." And so he had dated a girl named Ruth Burns, so he figured that was her. So he went upstairs and knocked on the door. And then this woman he didn't recognize at all came to the door. And he says, "Well, where is Ruth?" And she said, "She went down to the bathroom, to the hallway, down the hallway to the bathroom." They didn't have bathrooms in the rooms in 1949. And so, but she said, "But come on in, you know, she'll be right back." So he figured, okay. So he walked inside and he sat down on the edge of the bed. And he noticed that Ruth didn't really pay that much attention to him. She went over to the closet and she opened the door. And she took out a .22 caliber rifle and turned around and shot him right through the chest. Barely missed his heart. It was about 5 centimeters above his heart. And he's laying there on the floor bleeding. He says, "Honey, why'd you do that?" And she said, "If I can't have you, nobody can." Obviously, she was mental.
Yeah.
So.
That's great. had issues, to say the least.
Know. And then she goes and calls the policeman and ambulance and sits there and held his hand. You know? Now, the thing was, that's where the articles disintegrated.
Ah.
I had no idea what happened. For 30 years, I had no idea what happened. And so one night I was sitting there, and I always had this idea in my head, this old story, and I said, "I'll just make up something." So finally, I sat down and I started writing the first page of House of Ruth. Mm-hmm. And about halfway through that page, this name, Ruth Steinhagen, popped in my head. I can't remember half the girls I dated, but I'm certainly not a woman's name I read on a ceiling in 1972.
Fantastic.
And I Googled that, and I had all the information I ever needed right from that.
And if you want to find out how the story ends, folks, it's called A Den of Rhyme. Very quickly, where can they get this?
Well, you can buy it on Amazon.
Okay.
You can go to Amazon.com and just type in my name on the books.
Craig Farris, CRAIGFARIS, Craig Farris.
Yes, with one R.
With one R, A Den of Rhyme, it's called, a short story collection. He also has his first book that was published, The Spectrum Conspiracy. So you got a couple of great stories there. Sir, it's a pleasure. Very, very delightful conversation, and I'm going to keep this and finish reading it, by the way.
Thank you very much.
All right. This has been Straight Talk, brought to you by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax here with Founders and by Anderson Griggs Investments in Old Town Rock Hill. Common sense, intelligent advice for conservative investors. You can find out more online at AndersonGriggs.com. We broadcast from Substation 2 on Cherry Road in Rock Hill, across from Winthrop University. Cherry Road here, and of course, the magical way they make those subs and salads, as Craig and I will now tell you, is slice, 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 garden, garden, garden. Manny Kimmel back with you tomorrow.